Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like
you could just see
$600,000 deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out to Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. Is who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven, the radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking, And Master Ronnie saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing, right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person and they have food and you have water and they have no water and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself. Right? And so, like, if you go to Eddie V's and you're a nice person, right, and you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food, they are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you've served somebody other than you, and that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people. And if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has like a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? There are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value, right? And there's things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do PERC, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void that I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in like dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food like at a very high level, right? That's why people who, so for me, like, I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had seven boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat two, three, or four sandwiches, right? So, but I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we'd go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars, right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people are like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative. Like, it depends on, like, what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I, like, have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was, for me, a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past, I've been out of shape. And in the past, my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past I used to have jobs, and they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means like they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude, okay? I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay, judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, they weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent. Okay, so but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian. Like it didn't matter if I was 7 or 17. Why? The answer was always going to be the same, because I said so. Right. So I liked autonomy. So when wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. And then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but like, you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now, I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around, okay, because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from Boss Moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from is present pursued. I don't think I spelled that right. Pursued victories create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now, will cause me to value that thing. And so I've got a value. I want to win. So because I want to win, okay, for instance, I'm going to put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great. Okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time, and he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town, and then his mom would call me, and I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again, and so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy, and every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. No, it's not on the news, it's not on ESPN, nobody knows but us, but we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one, is future, future pursued. I think I spelled that right. I don't know. Pursued visions create present perceived values. So what does that mean? That means I can see an outcome down the road that is worth sacrificing right now for, so I'll sacrifice the short term on the altar of the long term. I'll sacrifice, like, my pleasure right now because I've got this vision down the road, and I'll take some time off of playing golf, and I'll take some time off of practicing my guitar. I'll take some time off from something I want to do for me. Like, okay, give you for instance. I am a foodie. If I wanted to, I could easily weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. It would be easy. Like, I like food. You say, what kind of food? Almost all kinds. I mean, I don't like pork, and I don't like shrimp, and I don't like yucky stuff. It's disgusting. But I like to eat. And the better it is, the more of it I like to eat. I'm just keeping it real. Like, brother man can throw it down. I can fling it down. Hear me when I tell you. I mean, where are my foodies? Where are my foodies? Okay? But because I have this future vision, right? Like, I've got this future vision. I've got a granddaughter. She's 3. One of the highlights of my life, my entire existence on this planet as a human, was when I got to dance with my daughter at her wedding. That was a highlight for me. Okay? So, one of my future visions that I have is to dance with my granddaughter, not at her wedding. My 3-year-old granddaughter. She's not going to get married at 3. That's not what I mean. Like, my granddaughter who is 3, when she becomes an adult, one of my objectives is to dance with her at her wedding. Well, let's say she gets married when she's 21, like my daughter did. Okay? She'll be 4 in July. So that gives me 17 more years. Well, in 17 years, I'll be 79, right? You know what that tells me? That tells me, as much as I love food, and I do love it, I don't like it, y'all. Hear me when I tell you. If I'm going to eat something, I want it to taste. I don't even want to waste any time eating food that don't taste good. Okay, y'all tracking? Like, I'm the guy who, when I make spaghetti, I season the water I boil my noodles in. I'm that dude. Okay, how many of y'all tracking? Okay, now y'all know who y'all dealing with. Okay, so, just keeping it real. Okay, so, but because I want to dance with my granddaughter at her wedding, when she gets married, I don't eat food until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drink water in the morning. And I have a window to eat between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. It opens at 1 with a protein shake. Then I'll eat some snacks in between, like some carrot chips or some celery or something good with some different whatever dip I decide. I'll mix some honey mustard and some ranch. And I know that's not healthy. I don't really care. This is my vision, y'all. You do you. I'm going to do me. Okay, I know that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it's what I do right now. So if y'all want me to do better, pray for me. Okay, so. And then I'll eat dinner. So that's but I'm going to make sure my protein shake is really, really good. And I'm going to make sure my snacks are really, really good. And I'm going to make sure when I eat dinner, look at him, is really, really good. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you my value comes from something that I desire that's way in the future, that I'm willing to sacrifice right now on, right? Too many people, they don't understand that today is yesterday's tomorrow. And they act as if the actions they take today have no consequences in the future. Right? And so the definition of sacrifice is to let go of something of a lower nature so you can take a hold of something of a higher nature. And the best way for us to live our lives, it's like it's been proven, it doesn't matter whether it's in finances, whether it's in health, whether it's in relationships, it doesn't matter what arena we're talking about. Sacrificing the short term on the altar of the long term always ends better than sacrificing the long term on the altar of the short term. It always does. It's just like a principle of life. Okay, so now I know when I'm looking at my particular marketplace in whatever particular niche I'm looking at, then I know what I have to do if I want to create wealth is I have to figure out how to help somebody fill their past perceived voids, or how to win their present pursued victories, or how to fulfill their future pursued visions. How many of y'all check? How many of y'all check it? Tracking. Okay. So now when I'm looking at somebody, I know what kind of value, how to discover what you value. Because you're going to value one of those three things. Whatever you're working on in your life is probably going to fit into one of those three categories. Now, wealth is the result of value creation. The better your ability to create value for someone other than yourself, the wealthier you are. And sometimes that'll show up as money. Sometimes it'll show up as real estate. Sometimes it'll show up as like hard assets like gold and silver. But or it'll show up as digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But at the end of the day, whatever you pay for with money that you earned by creating value for someone other than yourself. So the very act of entrepreneurship, by its very nature, has to be self-sacrificing if you're going to win as an entrepreneur. How many of y'all got it? Wave at me. Say, I got it. Wave at me. Okay, good. Cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what God set up in Genesis chapter 1. And I call it the four levels of value. So because here's what y'all, like, here's one of the things I think we don't understand sometimes. All value is not created equally, right? What does that mean? All value is not created equally. So I can say, well, but I created this value. Yeah, but the problem is either you valued it or maybe one other person valued it. You wonder why. Like, if you're not doing well financially, I'm going to tell you why. Because the pool of people that you've decided to create value for is very small. Or the thing that you, the value that you've created for them, they value it at a very low level. Like, it's not like a big deal, right? I'm going to pay more for a car than I am for a pair of shoes. Why? That's a bigger value. Why? It can take me farther faster than a pair of shoes, right? So watch this. So like, even if I go to eat at Ocean Prime or I go to eat at Eddie V's and it costs $500 for dinner for like seven people or whatever, I value that more than I value the money, number one. But I also value it because it gives me the time that I want to spend or invest into the people that I care about the most, and I don't have to, like, I don't have to make the food, my wife doesn't have to make the food, my daughter doesn't have to make the food, my son-in-law, we can just sit down, we can go to dinner, we can pay somebody, they make all the stuff. Like, we don't have to go in the kitchen and do anything, we don't even have to open the refrigerator. It's amazing, they just keep bringing it to you. And then, you don't have to clean off the table. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't even have to put your own pepper on your food. They'll put the pepper on for you. This is amazing. And then, when you get done, you don't have to clean the table up. You don't have to wash any dishes. You just leave. What? Sign me up right now. How many of y'all checking? Like, so we have to get to the place in our lives where we realize that all value is not created equally, right? So while I'm giving you things that are not created equally, let me give you something that is created equally. Because all value is not created equally, all no's are created equally, but all yeses are not. What do I mean all no's are created equally? If you do a presentation to a potential client who does not have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no, it feels the exact same as if you do a presentation to somebody who does have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no. A no is 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 a no. Does that make sense? Okay. But if you talk to somebody who does not have the ability to take advantage of your offer, and you make an offer to that person, and they say yes, that's very different than when you talk to a person who has the desire to take advantage of your offer, and they say yes. They have the ability. One has the ability, one doesn't have the ability. Those are two very different yeses. All no's are created equally. All yeses are not. Why would you invest time talking to people who have neither the desire nor the willingness to buy your offer? That's why I don't do high-pressure sales. I'm just not interested in it. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. And if I got to drag you in, I'm going to have to drag you around. Like, I'm like, we would all do better if we would just realize there are already thousands, potentially tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people in the world who would love to buy, to purchase the value that we create if they only knew we existed. And if that were really the case, then I would be better off to spend my time to make myself findable than I am trying to find somebody to sell something to. Is what I'm saying making sense? Okay, so all value is not created equally. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God gave us the four levels of value. The lowest level of value is implementation. Implementation, oh, by the way, let me say this. Wealth is, it's like the value we create for other people, but here's what we have to understand about wealth. Wealth is a spiritual result. What do I mean wealth is a spiritual result? Well, let me ask you a question. Is it more spiritual for you to think about you or for you to think about someone else? Which one? Someone else. It's more spiritual for you to think about solving the problems of someone other than you. Okay? So wealth is a spiritual result. By the way, wealth is also a spiritual result because creativity is spiritual, right? And so if you're going to create value for somebody, that's also spiritual. So watch this. So the lowest level of value is implementation. What do I mean? This is like if you're on this level of value, if you're creating value for other people at the implementation level, you have limited. Who is limited? Everybody tap yourself on the chest, say, I have. You've limited your ability to earn. Why? Because you're only going to make somewhere between minimum wage and about $80,000 a year. Well, that sounds kind of painful. Why? Because you're using muscles, which are a physical resource, over time, which is a limited resource. So you're literally using a physical resource over a limited resource to produce an unlimited spiritual result. No wonder you're stuck. This is why I tell people, now, if you just love like mowing grass and you want to start a lawn care company, that's fine. You just love pressure washing, you want to start a pressure washing business, that's fine. You can make money and create a level of wealth, but a limited level of wealth with a pressure washing business. You can. Or a landscape business or a janitorial service. But here's the problem. You're anchoring your income generation to time and physical labor. That is always going to pay you at the lowest possible level. Why? Because muscles are a physical resource. Time is a limited resource. Wealth is an unlimited spiritual result. Okay, what's the next level? The next level is unification. Unification on this level, you're going to make somewhere between $40,000 a year and maybe if you're like at a Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, you might make $250,000 a year. Well, that... How many of y'all know $40,000 to $250,000 is better than minimum wage to $80,000, right? That's a better window. But, I mean, do you really, and maybe you do, but do you really want a whole year to go by and you only make $250,000? I mean, that's a question we have to answer for ourselves. And for some people, the answer is like, man, if I had a year went by and I made $250,000, that's more than $20,000 a month. Sign me up right now. Okay, great. Sign you up right now, but probably not sign you up forever, right? Can I get a witness, right? Like, it's not a bad place to start, but it's not where we want to land, okay? What is this? This unification on this level, the resource we use on this level is our management skills. Managing people is a higher spiritual activity than doing the thing yourself. Are y'all tracking? That's why when people get into management, they make more. This person over here, they're making tacos at Taco Bell, they're making minimum wage. This person might be a mechanic working at a Rolls-Royce dealership, or maybe a Mercedes dealership or BMW dealership. This person right here is managing Taco Bell. This person right here is a middle manager at Lockheed Martin. But the reality is, if some company is paying you $250,000 a year, they want you to know they own you. Am I telling the truth? They want you to know. They don't just want you to know they own you. They want you to know they know it. Right? And so, like, if that's what you desire, that's fine. But maybe there's a way to have a level of freedom beyond that. And I believe that wealth begins to be created above this line. Wealth begins on the level of communication. Communication. On the level of communication. Now, somebody said the quality of your life will be equal to the quality of your communication. Okay? So communication, the resource you use on this level is your mouth. Now, there's a caveat. You have to have a mouth. You have to be willing to learn to use it. To do what? Create messages that move the masses. It's amazing that this, all of this, is harder than this. But to become a person who's skilled at this is harder than just doing this. What do I mean? Some people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they don't have to develop a level of verbal diligence and verbal intelligence and verbal acuity. Right? I don't want to have to learn how to talk, so I'm just going to go ahead and keep on working my fingers to the bone. Well, that's one way to do it. Right? Okay. Well, so communication. On this level, low end, you should make at least $100,000 a year. If you can sell cars, you can make $100,000 a year selling cars, selling insurance. Right? Selling advertising, $100,000 a year. But on the high end, might make $100 million. Why? Because you're using your mouth to deliver value. Well, Myron, what do you mean $100,000? Like, you know who these people are? These people are salespeople, right? They're also authors. They write books. Like, our books probably make us $400,000 a year. Just books. I wrote them once. Just get paid for them. Every day. What is it? It's a message communicated. It's like these words that came to my mind, and they actually came out of my mouth. Like I communicated a message that makes me hundreds of... I communicated messages. One of the books I wrote in 2006. This is 2023. That's 17 years. This book has been making me money for 17 years. We sold over 155, 160,000 copies of this one book. Now, who could write a book? Anybody could. Who will write a book? Almost no one. Okay. So, these people are coaches and teachers. And actors, and songwriters, and playwrights, right? Please don't let me forget this one, and YouTubers. It's crazy town. YouTube. Don't even get me started on YouTube, y'all. I might not be able to get off of it. Like YouTube? I had no idea. I've been on YouTube since 2007. I didn't even know there was a thing called turning on monetization until 2022. How many years is that? 15. I think it's 15. Ain't that 15? 15 years. I was on YouTube for 15 years. I didn't know all I had to do was click a button. They start paying me. Click a button. Like, this is how long it takes to click a button. Click. Get paid. I mean, I wasn't creating new videos. I had like 40 videos on. We turned on monetization, did no new videos. The first month, didn't do any new videos, hadn't done any new videos in like 8 months, turned on monetization, and we got paid $305. And Zach's like, we made $305 last month. And I said, for what? Because somewhere along the line, I communicated a message somebody wanted to see, and Google or YouTube was able to sell an ad on that. We're talking about 100, 200, this is amazing. I looked at it yesterday. I didn't know this was going to happen, so I didn't do it for this reason. Are you all tracking? What I'm about to tell you, I did not do for the reason I'm about to tell you what happened, okay? So we started doing YouTube videos intentionally April 1st last year. I looked at it yesterday. In the last 365 days, as of yesterday, We made $289,000 that YouTube paid us. I didn't know they were going to do that. No, you don't understand. I had no idea they were going to do that. Like, that wasn't why I did it. I mean, it was a nice side benefit, right? I've never had a job where I made $280,000 in my life. Most I've ever made at a job is $30,000, ever, as a full-grown man with a family. And YouTube paid me $289,000 for turning on a camera and running my mouth. Where the camera? Turn on the camera. I got something to say. The highest level of value is imagination. It still blows my mind. The resource you use at this level is your mind and your money to make money, to create value for other people. And what happens is at this level, on the low end, you're going to make $1 million. On the high end, it could be billions. And I know that sounds crazy. There's one YouTuber. This dude has 150 million subscribers. He gets over 100 million views a month. 100 million views. If he only makes $2 a view, that's 200 million a month. Are y'all tracking? It's just the whole world that we live in is kind of insanical. It's kind of the combination of insane and maniacal put together. So we can fight to stay down here, and people will do it too, because this, everything you do down here is hard. But I don't know if anything's harder than thinking. Thinking is the hardest work most people never do. In fact, I believe that most people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they can maintain a state of mental laziness. They will work hard at what's not working so they don't have to think about what would work. Most people will work hard at what's not working so they won't have to think about what would work. They will maintain a state of physical diligence, like working their fingers to the bone, sweat, blood, tears, so they don't have to think about what would work. So they can maintain a state of mental laziness. Most people are so mentally lazy, it's pathetic. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Myron, I don't know what Bible you've been reading. I did not see that in chapter 1. Okay, I'm going to read it to you. It's kind of mind-blowing. So a couple things. One is that Genesis chapter 1, I believe, if all God wanted us to know from Genesis chapter 1 was that he created everything, Genesis chapter 1 could have been Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Then he starts going into all this detail. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. Like, what is all that about? Well, the first thing God tells about God is not that he is love, even though he's love. It's not that he's holy, even though he's holy. The first thing that God tells about God is not that he's omniscient or omnipresent or omnipotent, even though he is all those things. The first thing God tells about God is that he's creative. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. What's the first thing God tells about us? The first thing he tells about us is that he created us in his image, which means he created us to create stuff and he made us to make stuff. What does that mean? What that means is when God created everything, after he created everything, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. After he did it, then he went back and documented the process, so when we got ready to create value for someone else, we'd have a pattern. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That was his intention. And the earth was without form. That word was not, used to be, it became, without form and void. So disruption always follows intention, right? And darkness upon the face of the deep. So when disruption comes, it comes in the form of devoidness, deformity, and darkness. Like things get broken. There's confusion. Darkness is a picture of confusion and fear and anxiety. And then the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water. So you have this intention, and then disruption follows your intention. So now you've got to find a source of inspiration. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. God said, let there be light. That's illumination. You've got to learn something you didn't know so you can see something you couldn't see. You see what happens when we when we see God's not just, he's not just, well, I just happen to do this. No. He's showing us what to do. And then he took time to see what he had created, and then he recognized that it was good. See, some of us, we'll go do all this really great stuff, and then we won't even take time to enjoy what we've created. You're not even being like God. Okay, y'all tracking. So it gets more better. So here it is, Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to show y'all where I got this from. Genesis chapter numero uno. Here we go. Here's what it says. When God created man, I'm going to just go down to that part. Here's what it says, verse 26. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that moveth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God created him, male and female created he them. So, and God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Okay, so here's the first thing we see. And God said, it's really interesting. So if you go back and read Genesis chapter 1, what you'll see it says, and God said, Genesis 1, I think it's verse 3, and God said, let there be light. Maybe it's verse 4. And God said, let there be light, right? Okay, when God created creation, he said, let there be. Let there be light. Let there be a firmament that separates the waters from the waters. So when God created creation, there's three categories. There's creation, there's creatures, and there's creators. When God created creation, he said, let there be. When God created creatures, he said, let the earth bring forth and let the waters bring forth. Let the earth bring forth the cattle and the creeping things. Let the water bring forth the fish and the fowl. What is God doing? He's delegating some of the work that he did to something that he's already created. So we could call that delegation. We could call that automation. Right? Are y'all tracking? So that you're not doing everything. Okay. So y'all tracking. Okay. Now, but when he created man, he didn't say, let there be man. That shows us that man is not a higher form of animal. He didn't say, let the earth bring forth man. He didn't say, let the waters bring forth man. So we know that man is very, very different than creation, and he's very, very different than creatures. How do we know that? Because what God said when he created them was different. When he created creation, he said, let there be. When he created creatures, he said, let the waters bring forth, let the earth bring forth. When he created man, here's what he said, let us. Let us make man in our image. Oh, what's he saying? I'm about to do something different, y'all. Than everything I've already done, I saved the best for last. It's about to be on, y'all. Okay, now, God said, let us make man in our image. You know what that means? Before God could say, let us make man in our image, the image had to exist first. That's why imagination is the highest level, because it represents God. It's the God realm. God said, there's the communication. By the way, could God have made man in his image without saying it? Yes, he could have. But he said it. Why? Because that's part of our creative power, is to create messages that move us and messages that move others. Here's what the scripture says. A man shall eat good by the fruit of his mouth. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. Thou shalt also declare a thing, and it shall be established where? Unto thee. I'm not talking about speaking things into existence. You can't do that. I can't do that. Only God could do that. That's a bara. The only person in Scripture who baras is God. But what I can do is I can talk to myself like David did when he did what? Encouraged himself in the Lord. How do you encourage yourself in the Lord? Say the same thing to yourself that God said to you about you. When I speak God's word to me, guess what I'm doing? I am installing faith into a space where doubt used to exist so I can take an action in faith that I could not take in doubt. How many of y'all track it? Why? How do I know that? Because faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by what? The word of God. So the best thing I can do for me is to say the same thing about me that God says about me. Because when I see myself like he sees me, now I can do what he says I can do and not what other people say I can't do. Are y'all tracking? And so this is where I got the four levels of value, right? So when we're working at those highest levels, we're working that imagination realm. Then we start communicating, we're working that communication realm. But God didn't say, let me make man in my image. What did he say? Let us make man in our image. That's the unification part. Two are better than one, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Are y'all, like, this is so powerful for, like, the money is nothing more than proof that you've created the value. The wealth is the value that you create for someone other than yourself. And if you create enough value for enough other people, there's nothing in this world that you desire that you can't have. Now, and maybe that's not even what you want. There's nothing in this world that I desire that I don't already have. So somebody commented on one of my videos, somebody commented on one of my videos, they said, but you can't take it with you. And I can't take the lot I got with me, you can't take the little you got with you. We ain't taking none of it with us, that's first. But I said, I have neither the desire, nor the inclination to take any of it with me. I'm not working to take it with me. I'm working so that I can keep contributing to the charities and the ministries that I contribute to, and so that I can leave the rest to my children and my children's children. I have no intention of taking it with me. I can send some ahead, and I can leave the rest here. I have no desire to take any with me. Myron, how much money do you want to make? As much as I can. How much wealth do you want to create? As much as I can. But wealth is not the money. Wealth is the value that I create for someone other than me. Okay, I gotta finish. The last thing it says, Genesis chapter 2, because I didn't realize Larry didn't tell me that I was getting ready to go overtime, but that's okay. It's okay. Now I know who I'm dealing with. Okay. Larry's my dude. Okay, so here's what it says. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living soul. I'm going to finish with this. God formed. What is that? That's the implementation. The last thing God did was made the physical part of man. Then what did he do? He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. The man that he made in his imagination with his communication, patterned after his unification, he breathed that man into the body that he formed. And the man became a living soul. That's why I call these the four levels of value. Now y'all know where I got it from in Genesis chapter 1. By the way, it's confirmed in Genesis chapter 11. The people in Babel were trying to build a tower whose top could reach heaven. Do you know how ridiculous that sounds in a day where they don't have hydraulics, they don't have helicopters, they don't have cranes? But here's what it says. The Lord God came down to see the tower and the sun, the city and the tower which the sons of men builded. And he said, this people is one, that's unification. They all have one language, that's communication, and one speech. Now this they begin to do, that's implementation. Now nothing will be restrained from them, which they've imagined to do. They are the four levels of value. If you apply these four levels, even working on something that's not good, it will still work. That's how powerful it is, because it's a principle, and principles are God's automation. So let's make sure we apply the four levels of value to something good and not to something evil. I hope that blesses you. Thank you for subscribing. By the way,
coffee and Ethiopia are so related. Some people say it's a way of showing love to one another. While I was growing up too, we see coffee as socializing between neighbors, living in the neighborhood. They gather around coffee to have a cup of coffee. Usually they don't have one cup, they have three cups.
Ethiopia and coffee are intertwined. The country prides itself as being the birthplace of coffee, roughly discovered in the 9th century. The coffee origin story strongly influenced the culture, traditions, and methods of how coffee is made throughout the country.
There is a common legend which everybody knows about the goat herder who found out that his goats were acting differently from before. He was herding his goat in the Kaffa Mountains, so he followed them what they were eating to be so active and so hyper. He found out that they were having reddish berries, and once they tasted that, they became so energetic and they jump around. At that time, there was a monastery nearby. So he went with the berry, tell them what happened. The abbot wasn't excited, so he threw it in the fire. They roasted it unintentionally. He saw the aroma of the smell of the coffee. He had to try it. So they washed it and so they tried it. That's why we started the coffee.
Originally, it's traditional coffee in Ethiopia. Now, things started changing. We go to machine coffee. I think now I prefer machine coffee than traditional coffee. I think because it comes fast. Traditional coffee needs processing. It needs minimum of 1 hour, 1.5 hour. When you come to machine coffee, you do it in 15 minutes.
When they prepare the coffee traditionally, they have the small pots, the small glasses.
These are called sini, and it's a pretty much a traditional cup that is used in Ethiopia when having coffee ceremony or drinking coffee. We have popcorn, which is also a popular snack while having the ceremony. This is called tat, which is grass. And when you're having a grand celebration like this, you have it all over your house, and it just brightens it up. And this is ambasha. It's a type of bread that is made in Ethiopia. It's really good. It's also another popular snack. And this is buna, which is coffee. I'm roasting it right now.
The next few steps entail manually grinding the coffee and then scooping the grinded coffee into a clay pot called a jebena. The whole process takes a few hours to complete, leaving plenty of time to socialize. Once done, 3 rounds of coffee is distributed to each guest.
They drink the first cup, it's called Abol. It's very strong. It has a lot of ground coffee. And the second, they put water in it. It's called Tona. And they put water. For the third time, it's called Baraka. That's how we came for the dark roast, medium roast, light roast. The first shop of coffee shops was opened in Italy. They came up with the machines. They brought it to Addis. We are the source of coffee. The demand of coffee. We cannot serve forever in the pots in the traditional way. Yes, it's good. We have to find a quicker way. And here we are.
Established in 1953, this coffee shop is part of the first coffee roasting company in Ethiopia.
Since the opening of the shop, we have machinery who dates back to the starting of this business. So we only use authentic, old machinery. We had to find a way to serve this quickly and efficiently. They had to taste that good Ethiopian coffee. So we had to bring the Italian machines along to spice our flavorsome coffee.
Italian machine coffee rapidly changed the pace of how coffee is made in Ethiopia. In the streets of Addis Ababa, you are spoiled for choice when looking for a quality cup of coffee. The smell radiates in the air, the beans flow in their bloodstream. It's more than just a drink, it's part of who they are.
With nearly 30,000 cafes across the globe, Starbucks has become more than just a household name. From its iconic cups, often adorned with misspelled names, to the espresso inside them, Starbucks has catapulted from one coffee bean shop in Seattle to a sprawling $80 billion business over the last 47 years. Starbucks sales account for 57% of the total cafe market. Yes, 57%. Nearly two-thirds of all coffee sold at cafes in the U.S. comes from a Starbucks. But this impressive expansion hasn't come without growing pains. With more than 14,000 locations in the U.S. alone, Starbucks has spread itself too thin. Having too many stores has led to fewer transactions at individual stores. To compensate, the company has raised prices. But doing this too quickly or too often can drive customers away. So how did this happen? And what's a coffee giant to do about it? The year is 1970. Three college friends, Zev Siegel, Jerry Baldwin, and Gordon Boker, decide to get into the coffee business. They found a mentor in Alfred Peet, founder of Peet's Coffee, and the man responsible for bringing custom coffee roasting to the U.S.
He knew the coffee industry inside and out, especially the gourmet end. He was the most educated coffee guy in the country at that time.
So with Peet's help, the three friends opened Starbucks, a coffee bean shop and roastery at Seattle's famous Pike Place Market in 1971. Peet provided the young entrepreneurs with roasted coffee beans and connected them with coffee brokers until they could set up their own roastery and source their own beans. For the first decade, the founders opened 5 more locations in Seattle. At this point, contemporary coffee consumers might have noticed a glaring absence, actual coffee drinks. But that's the thing about the 70s coffee culture. It didn't really exist outside the home.
There were no coffee bars, nor was there much of a demand for espresso-based drinks. You purchased coffee beans, and you either took them home as beans, or we ground them for you in the store. Nobody expected to get a beverage at a Starbucks coffee store until after 1980.
Starbucks' initial focus was bringing high-quality beans to consumers who were more accustomed to instant or canned coffee. But that changed with the addition of one man.
The company hired its first really professional director of marketing and sales. And that man was Howard Schultz. And he couldn't figure out why we weren't selling beverages.
In 1983, Schultz travels to Italy and returns with an idea. Turn the coffee bean stores into cafes. Starbucks served its first latte the next year. The experiment was a success, and 4 years later, Schultz partnered with investors and bought Starbucks for $3.8 million. He was only 34 at the time. Schultz pursued a strategy of aggressive expansion. By the time the company went public in 1992, it had 165 stores. By 1996, it had opened more than 1,000 locations, including its first international cafes in Japan and Singapore. Growth was so rapid that just 3 years later, Starbucks opened its 2,000th location.
Once they found a business model that worked, that translated to other geographies, that gave them the opportunity to really accelerate growth, really put the pedal to the metal in terms of expanding across the globe.
Schultz switched from CEO to executive chairman in 2000, at which time Starbucks operated 3,500 stores in more than a dozen countries. Between 2000 and 2007, the number of Starbucks cafes more than quadrupled, from 3,500 to over 15,000. During this period, the company opened an average of 1,500 stores every year, including 2,500 in 2007 alone. Sales shot up from $2 billion to $9.4 billion. Consumers were increasingly ditching their kitchen mugs for these iconic paper-to-go cups. But then Starbucks hit a wall. 2007 financial crash. That year, its rapid growth screeched to a halt, and its stock price plummeted by 50% as cash-strapped consumers backed away from pricey coffee habits.
The Great Recession was devastating for the restaurant industry. What we typically saw was more trading out, so consumers taking a pause on that everyday luxury that Starbucks offered.
So Starbucks brought back Howard Schultz. This news alone caused Starbucks stock to shoot up by 9%. Schultz halted growth and focused on customer experience. He shuttered cafes, more than 600 in 2008 and another 300 in 2009, and laid off around 6,700 baristas. A month after his return, Schultz ordered Starbucks to close all of its U.S. locations for one afternoon so he could retrain more than 135,000 baristas about how to make its signature espresso. Schultz's goal was to remind customers what they loved about the brand by making the stores an experience, not just a place to get a quick coffee. They stopped selling breakfast sandwiches and brought back in-house grinding, infusing the cafes once again with that fresh coffee aroma. Schultz even mandated the removal of automatic espresso machines. These made service faster but removed much of the romance and theater of watching baristas craft each cup of coffee. Schultz's makeover worked. The company's stock soared more than 143% in 2009, and same-store sales rebounded. Starbucks has posted positive same-store sales ever since. During Schultz's makeover of the cafes, Starbucks barely opened any new stores, but the pace picked up again in 2012. By 2017, Starbucks opened nearly 3,000 more locations, ending the year with 28,000 cafes around the world. However, this brings us back to the first problem, profit cannibalization. Oversaturation, particularly in urban locations, has spread sales thin. Because Starbucks has so many locations, customers don't have to be loyal to just one. So even if Starbucks' overall sales are growing, its individual same-store sales won't reflect it. Compounding this problem are changing consumer preferences. People are shying away from sugar-laden calorie bombs, which happens to be one of Starbucks' staples. These signature frappuccinos contain an average of 57 grams of sugar. That's more than double the recommended daily limit of sugar. So to combat these problems, Starbucks is changing once again. The company announced the closure of 150 stores in 2019. That may seem like a drop in the bucket for a sprawling company like Starbucks, but it's three times the number of stores it usually closes each year. The company will still open stores, but future growth will be more focused. Additionally, decadent drinks topped with whipped cream are taking a back seat, Instead, the company is pushing lighter drinks like cold brew and its fruity refreshers. The company also plans to roll out delivery to a quarter of its company-owned stores by the middle of 2019. Perhaps the company's biggest undertaking is its new line of upscale stores, Starbucks Reserve Roasteries. These massive 20,000 square foot stores are designed to be a tourist destination. Here, Starbucks baristas and bartenders experiment with different brewing methods and craft new, innovative beverages. These have proven popular. In the first weeks, the Shanghai Roastery made an average of $64,000 every day, which is double what a regular cafe makes in a week. The company has opened 4 roasteries so far, with plans for 2 more.
It doesn't look and feel like anything else that Starbucks has. Those are the kind of experiential stores, the high-end experience stores that consumers are really looking for. But I think what's going to be more interesting coming out of that is the halo effect that puts the brand in a higher light among consumers. Yeah, that's pretty meaningful.
Hey everyone, Sam Ovens here, and today I have Danielle Leslie on with us, and Danielle's got an awesome story, and she started a few years ago working at Udemy, which is like an online course company, and she was helping online course.
Coffee. Over 125 million people today are, in some form, employed in the industry surrounding it worldwide, helping to bring the world the 400 billion cups of coffee it consumes each year. Many, in fact, consider having at least a morning cup of coffee a necessary part of having a productive day, or at least a stable one. The main reason for this, unless you're drinking decaf, is the famous, invigorating, and generally safe drug called caffeine. Coffee has helped to fuel mankind and its various pursuits for centuries, but how long, exactly? Where did coffee come from, and how did it take over the world? Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to Fire of Learning. I'm Justin. In this video, we will be exploring the fascinating origins of coffee. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Lamia Bukris, Eric Rader, Beth Baird, Mike Fantasia, Stephen Colonna, Michael McGinnis, Nicola Lonechar, Everett White, Anubis Anarchy, Faceless Buster, David M.D., Lene Casperson, Blaine Arahara, Carolis, and Alan Hasty for being our most recent supporters on Patreon. They join these supporters who help make these videos possible. Also, a past patron had his name mispronounced. Jacob Sewers is actually Jacob Sievers. This video is an improved remake of a video I did years ago. Now then, let's get to it. Many societies, such as the United States, home to many of the world's most famous coffeehouse chains, consider coffee to be a central part of their dietary culture. However, though caffeine itself has been consumed by humans in some form since before recorded history, for most of human history, coffee itself was unknown to the world. The story begins in the late Middle Ages and early modern era, with the berries of a small tree native to Oromia, a region of what is today the East African nation of Ethiopia. This is the homeland of the kaffiyeh plant. When exactly people first stumbled upon and consumed the berries of the kaffiyeh plant and felt the stimulating effects of the red berries or cherries is not known. One legend attributes the discovery to an Ethiopian goat herder named Kaldi, who lived sometime between the 6th and 9th century. One day, he noticed some of his goats had become quite energetic after chewing on the red berries of an unfamiliar shrub. Made curious by his dancing goats, he tried the berries for himself and felt these energizing effects. Believing his discovery to be quite important, he took the berries to a local monk. The monk, however, rejected them and cast them into a nearby fire. However, the smell of the roasting coffee seeds within the berries, which are usually called beans, although they're technically not, caught his attention, as well as the attention of other nearby monks. The beans were taken from the fire, ground up, and mixed into a cup of water. Thus, the first cup of coffee. This story, which seems to come from European writers from the late 1600s, is probably much more legend than history. One of a handful of legends pertaining to the discovery of coffee, in fact. No one knows who first discovered the effects of coffee, and we likely never will. However, it is certainly quite possible that the true story is not too dissimilar. Caffeine is a deadly poison to insects. It's believed that caffeine naturally functioned as a pesticide, overloading the nervous system of insects, causing them to die before they could consume a large portion of the plant. However, that same effect on a much larger creature, like a human or perhaps a goat, is a much more survivable and enjoyable experience. One way or another, Ethiopian locals, likely the Gala tribe, discovered this effect of the coffee berry. However, it does not appear that they were the first to make a drink from the seeds. Rather, that appears to have happened in the nearby Islamic world. Like in Africa, it appears that the Arabs first chewed the beans and made drinks from them, which historians believe were quite different from modern coffee. This may have begun sometime around the 10th century or so. The Persian scholar Al-Razi seems to have mentioned the stimulating effects of the berries around this time. The Arabs called the drink they made from the berries kabwa, a word interestingly related to their word for wine and likely the origin of the modern word for coffee across most languages. When they began making coffee in its modern form is not known, but it seems to have been sometime between the 10th and 15th century. There is clear, written evidence of the consumption of coffee in the Islamic world by at least the 15th century, a drink which they again gave the same name as the other drink, kabwa. According to Bennett Allen Weinberg and Bonnie K. Beeler in The World of Caffeine, the earliest certain appearance of coffee in its modern form comes from the mid-15th century, in the monasteries of Sufi monks in Yemen, which was just across the Red Sea. They also note there is a strange lack of discussion about coffee beans or potentially coffee itself, the beans being called boon or boonsham, between the 10th and 15th centuries, with the exception of folk accounts, such as that of the Sheikh Omar. His story is another one pertaining to the supposed discovery of coffee. He is said to have survived off the berries and the drink he brewed from them after having been banished, and introduced them to his people in the 12th century. Why this 500-year gap regarding the discussion of coffee exists is yet another coffee mystery. Anyway, it appears to have reached the city of Mocha in modern-day Yemen by that time. It soon reached nearby Mecca. From there, Mecca being a Mecca of the Islamic world after all, it spread out across the Middle East and North Africa. Interestingly, coffee initially had a religious significance to many Muslims, especially the Sufis, who used it to assist in fasting during Ramadan, as well as to aid them in staying awake at night for prayers. It was also believed to have carried many medicinal benefits, some of which, though not all of course, scientists today know consuming it really does have. Quite quickly though, in a society which forbade alcohol, it became a drink of the common people for normal, casual use. What followed were places for men, men of all classes, but men only, to congregate and consume the beverage. These were the first coffee houses. Women could consume coffee at home, though in some circumstances, they were allowed to sing at coffee houses, provided they were hidden from view. These coffee houses became places of both relaxation and games, but also serious discussion and argument. Not everyone approved, however. Other Muslims felt that the ban on intoxicants, such as alcohol, mentioned in the Quran, should apply to coffee as well. Furthermore, coffee houses became sources of trouble, centers of debauchery forbidden by Islamic law, and hotbeds of political unrest. Indeed, at certain points and in certain places, such as the city of Mecca in 1511, coffee and coffee house bans were enacted, forcing the trade and consumption underground. In some cases, trading and consuming coffee was punishable by death. The spread to the Christian world seems to have come via the burgeoning Ottoman Empire, which ruled over parts of Europe and much of the Middle East. The Ottomans conquered Yemen in 1536. Syrians introduced coffee to the capital of Constantinople in the 1550s, and the Turks became very enthusiastic about it. Many European merchants and travelers first observed it there, tried it on some occasions, and sometimes wrote of it. Coffee's gradual introduction to Europe appears to have been through both war and trade. In 1565, the Ottomans attempted to conquer the island of Malta. They were defeated, however, by the Knights of St. John. They took Ottoman soldiers as slaves, who introduced the Maltese to coffee. Decades later, the Venetians became interested in the drink, and acquired it through trade, becoming the first to introduce the drink to the continent. Throughout the late 1500s, coffee quickly spread to many other parts of Europe. England, France, the other Italians, and the Dutch were especially interested. The people of Europe began to search for the plant which produced these wonderful new beans. The Dutch were the first to succeed in 1616 when a sly merchant, Peter van der Brugge, acquired them while in the city of Mocha. This was no simple task. The Yemenis guarded their coffee supply closely, requiring that any beans which left the area be boiled or roasted to prevent germination. However, Peter was not the first to succeed in smuggling them. A Muslim pilgrim had already succeeded in bringing them to India by taping the seeds to his stomach under his clothes. Still, Broca's success was of great importance to his people. He took them back to his home in the Netherlands, where he began to successfully grow them. However, such cold climates as Northern Europe are not ideal for large-scale coffee production. Thankfully for the Dutch, however, in this time they were in the business of acquiring tropical colonies, such as the island of Sri Lanka, south of India, the island of Java in Indonesia, and Suriname in South America. The Dutch East India Company spearheaded European coffee production in these areas in the late 16 and early 1700s, fueling Europe's new coffee addiction for many years. Other European empires would follow suit in their warmer colonies as well. In 1720, Gabriel de Cleux brought coffee to the island of Martinique. Legend says he introduced it to the island and kept it alive on his ship by sharing his limited water ration with it, though in truth others may have already brought it there. Much of the coffee drank around the world, Arabica, is said to be descended from his plants. Arabica, by the way, is one of the four main varieties of coffee drank around the world to this day, accounting for about 65% of production. The other main one being Robusta, which makes up much of the remainder. Liberica and Excelsa are somewhat rarer. Anyway, coffee was also farmed by the slaves of the French colony of Saint-Domingue, modern-day Haiti, which would later begin to produce massive amounts of coffee as well. The first European coffee houses opened in Venice in 1645. The rest of Europe followed suit, with thousands of coffee houses springing up throughout the continent in the subsequent decades. European coffee houses were not quite as rowdy as the Middle Eastern counterparts, as they already had pubs with alcohol for that. Thus, they were more likely to become centers of intellectual culture. However, that does not mean they were not centers of trouble at all. Coffee houses were frequent meeting places for those seeking to discuss new ideas which often contradicted the ideas of ruling political elites. In 1675, Charles II, the son of a king who had had his head cut off by political dissidents after a civil war, attempted to shut down coffee houses throughout England, but retracted his order when the public outcry was too great. Likewise, French Enlightenment philosophers were later known for gathering in coffee houses in the years prior to the French Revolution. Coffee wasn't always popular with those supportive of the Enlightenment, however. In his book, Uncommon Grounds, Mark Pendergast shares a quote from Frederick the Great, the 18th century King of Prussia, and, by the way, friend of the enthusiastic coffee addict Voltaire, in which he denounced it. He was recorded to have said, "It is disgusting to notice the increase in the quantity of coffee used by my subjects, and the like amount of money that goes out of the country in consequence. My people must drink beer. His Majesty was brought up on beer, and so were his ancestors." End quote. He then banned the roasting of coffee outside of government establishments for 4 years. Old Fritz was known for being a bit of a curmudgeon. In Frederick's defense, importing coffee to Prussia was costly. Others, however, believed that coffee had helped to bring sobriety to their countries and were glad to see the change. Like in the Islamic world, Christians initially also had religious concerns about coffee. Though their concerns were not as strong, they did have concerns about a Muslim drink becoming popular among their people. However, when Pope Clement VIII tried it around the year 1600, he gave it his blessing. It is claimed, and it may or not be true, that he said, quote, "Why, this Satan's drink is so delicious that it would be a pity to let the infidels have exclusive use of it. We shall cheat Satan by baptizing it and making it a truly Christian beverage," end quote. And thus, the Catholic world, especially Italy and eventually France, accepted coffee and never looked back. The Italians in particular would become creative with coffee, inventing many ways of having it, including espresso. In Victorian England, Christian prohibitionists encouraged coffee houses as an alternative to alcohol. A few branches of Christianity, however, eventually did decide against coffee, most famously the Mormons. In 1683, a massive Ottoman army attempted to conquer the Austrian capital of Vienna. At the Battle of Vienna, they were defeated by a combined Christian force who, upon pillaging the Ottoman army camps, found coffee. Initially, they assumed it was camel food, so they burned it. But thankfully for them, a commander who had lived in the Ottoman Empire for a time recognized the smell. This helped coffee's immediate spread throughout Central and Eastern Europe. Coffee was very well received throughout Europe. However, throughout this time, it should be remembered that coffee was in competition with tea, for which the British, for example, developed preference. This was the case in their American colonies as well. That is, of course, until the Tea Act was placed upon them. After American patriots held the Boston Tea Party in 1773, tea became a symbol of royal tyranny, and Americans began to prefer coffee, which they still do to this day, though it was expensive and less common in America in those days. For example, in 1774, John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail saying, quote, "Tea must be universally renounced, and I must be weaned. The sooner the better." Caffeine was first separated from coffee by Friedrich Ferdinand Runge in 1819 at the suggestion of Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Coffee only reached isolationistic Japan in 1858.
There's a direct...
Okay, today's podcast, I'm going to open up the phone lines here in a moment, is Build Assets Daily. Build Assets Daily. Ooh. I don't know how I can sew all this together, but I'm going to attempt to. Build assets, what I mean by build assets daily, because I'm going to mention some names here that you can go study up on them. But we started off Monday, because this is Black History Month. So Delmar mentioned, the history of coffee. Now, the history of coffee, and I'm just really... paraphrasing a micro in nanoseconds, really the origins of it, if you get the history of it, goes back to Africa, particularly East Africa. But and Ethiopian countries like Rwanda, Somalia, Ethiopia, also Uganda, there are probably others, but in East Africa, some of the, their chief exports that keep those economies good, export coffee. All right. But how come we haven't heard, because we've heard of Starbucks, which is out of the state of Washington, headquarters, I believe, Seattle, Washington, or somewhere in that state. How come you can go to China, there's a Starbucks. You go to Denmark, there's a Starbucks. So how come we haven't heard about, coffee being some type of major brand name? And you can go on Amazon. You can go on Amazon and buy coffee from Ethiopia and Rwanda and probably some other places in Africa. But the brands that you probably never even heard of before. All right, so, and that comes to what I want to tie into today's podcast, which is titled Build Assets Daily, and I'm going to just throw some information out here. Once again, the origins of coffee are out of Africa, and we went over a little bit on that Monday. But let's take a look at Starbucks. Now, Starbucks, obviously they did not originate the coffee industry, although when it comes to consumer-based coffee, they're probably number one on the planet. But essentially, Starbucks is in the water business. They essentially sell water. At its base, it's the coffee that brings people into the door, and you get your latte or whatever. But they're essentially selling water. Now, here's another thing about water. Water and I have my wealth metric. My wealth metric is probably different than most people, probably different than probably 95% of the population. Because I really don't measure wealth in terms of government-issued legal tender in this country known as United States dollars, or if you go to Argentina, they got the peso. I measure it in natural resources. Now, that's not my only metric. I have about 12 metrics of wealth, but number one is natural resources. And if you go to the, and I haven't stepped foot in the church in years, but if you look at the Old Testament, Genesis, first chapter, that like the first, look at the second and third sentences there. The first chapter of Genesis, and then you look at, the Torah, which the first chapter, they're the same book, just Torah's the Jewish people and Christians, they, you know, Old Testament. So, but if you look at, like, the second sentence, or second or third sentence, is they mention water. We'll go through that a whole nother day, but water. So water is, I consider that a wealth metric. So essentially, Starbucks, and now the thing is, a lot of people take water for granted, and there's a lot of money in water, all right? But what they've done, which is, I believe, what anybody can do, is essentially assets daily. They build them daily. They open. You take a look at Walmart or Starbucks. They essentially open up. If they don't open up a new store every day, it's something's happening within every week where they're building assets daily. Now, let's scale this down, because some people might think, well, you know, 3,000 stores, 5,000 stores, 1,000 stores, those numbers might be intimidating to the average person. So I'm going to name three people. One of them you've heard of, we played, that's the reason why I play these audios so much. Steve Harvey, how did he play that $22 million tax bill? Essentially, Steve built assets. Now, his assets, a lot of people don't even consider them assets, but they are. How did he pay off? Now, he paid off that $22 million tax bill because he was paying, his payment plan was $650,000 a month. Now, how did he do it? Well, just to quickly, and we went over this like 3 weeks ago, but without playing audio again, as I played it earlier today, is number one, the Steve Harvey Morning Show is an asset. Now, with that asset, they essentially syndicate it or sell it to like 100-plus radio stations. So that one asset, which is his intellectual property, Steve, and it's about a total of six or seven people that produce the Steve Harvey Morning Show. Steve's just one of the six or seven. All right, and he's got like Struss, nephew Tommy, Strawberry, whatever her name is, Strawberry. But anyway, but so he's taking that one asset, and you know that's how he was able to. And then of course he did the stand up stuff on weekends, but the morning show bought in the bulk of that $650,000 a month. Because you heard what he said in the audio that we played earlier. IRS would shut him down seasons, and then he would have been in federal prison. But he paid that off. So now the other two names will be Angela Jasmina. If you go on her Facebook page, Angela Jasmina, she's a black woman out of Prince George's County, Maryland. She and her family earn $1 million a year from an asset that she and her family, we're going to open up the phone lines in a moment. Let me see. And let me get Chris in on this one. The last person I want to mention, his name is, I got to find his number. Randy Jones, which I've mentioned his name before. Give me a moment, people. Jesus, wait a minute. Okay. Oh, here we go. Let's see if this works.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. So, let me make sure everybody's here. Delma, are you there? Okay, Chris, I don't know. Chris is here. Okay. I don't know where Delma went. All right, so this guy, Randy Jones, who Chris is familiar with, Randy Jones built a tiny house for himself with, he started off with maybe a circular saw. I don't know. I don't even know if he owned that. He could have borrowed it. But he built one, but then somebody came to him and said, well, can you build him one? Now Randy builds 3 to 5 tiny houses per day. And, that's probably, Chris, would you say that's about $1 million a day if he builds 5?
Actually, it's coming up, if you figure each one of them between 25 and 50. So it's up to about $250,000 a day.
Oh, all right, $250,000. Yeah, a day. A day. But this guy started off, he's a humble guy. His YouTube channel is Incredible Tiny Homes. But this guy, you got to go back to some of his early videos where it was just him. It was just him. So the message I want to get across here is find something simple. In the case of Starbucks sells water. And like I say, water is, matter of fact, when I buy land, the primary reason why I buy land is, I would say the number one reason, water, groundwater. Because when I look at, matter of fact, everybody who's within the sound of my voice, step outside, look outside the window, go walking around the neighborhood. You're walking on water, number one, which I consider that earth wealth. And then number two, go take a look at a football field, which is about an acre. And when you take a look at a football field, there's over 1 million liters of water there, groundwater. Most people don't know that. Particularly people that live in heavily urbanized, like people that might live in a city like Miami, Boston, Los Angeles, those places. The city wants you to buy municipal water, and they don't tell you that you're sitting on a million liters of water. They don't tell you that, so you're stuck in consumer mode. So, for right now, if you can, although water might not be your thing, but that's one of my wealth metrics. Anyway, build assets here. So Angela Jasmine, she makes clothes for kids, and she turned it into an asset. And she builds daily. Sure, her husband, they build daily, and Randy Jones, he builds daily, like $250,000 a day. And that's just an 8-hour shift. He doesn't work these people 16 or, Chris, he doesn't go 24 hours. It's just what, 9 of like daylight hours, isn't it?
Yeah, this is just in a one shift.
8 hours.
Yeah, 8-hour yeah. Shift. And if they went to a second shift, now they're putting out 10 a day.
Right.
To 10 anyway.
Exactly. So, And anyway, so we'll cover more of this. Now, we're not going anywhere. So let's go to the phone lines here. 407, your mic is open. Well, she could have stepped away. 407, I'll leave that mic open. Chris, what do you got for us for today? Oh, wait a minute. Well, hold on, Chris. Yes, 407, your mic is open.
Thank you, L.A. I'm sorry, I was on mute. Grand day, great evening for the West and East Coast and Europe and all that. You know, the last thing we need on this planet is children's clothing. I have to say that because children outgrow clothes so fast, you end up taking them to a thrift store. That's what I have to do to my grandchildren. They're only 7 and 9, and it's like every 3 months they're not wearing the clothes you just bought them. So it doesn't pay, in my opinion, to be buying new clothes for children. They outgrow them too fast. Anyway, I just want to say that this Jasmine person.
Oh, I got to ask you a question, though. I got to ask you a question on that. Okay, now, and you're right, because when I was young, I probably outgrew clothes faster than the average person, because I was like 12 years old, I was probably 6-something, but anyway. But the thing is, now, we're living in a culture here in the United States where, you know, how can you tell a young mother not to buy new clothes?
You have to educate people, L.A. We are in a society, a culture, a world that is changing its values. You remember we've been talking about values and what's wealth? If you keep buying
right.
new clothes, children, that's a waste of money. Value, have value. They're going to outgrow them, and then you end up either giving them away or exchanging them. There's a store here called Once Upon a Child. And there are a concession place where you can go and take your old clothes. If they buy them, you can get credit and you can buy the clothes that are all. There's tons of used clothes in this store. It's like, where are all these clothes coming from? Parents who bought new clothes and their children outgrew them. We don't need any more children's clothes. That's all I'm just suggesting. Think good used clothing that have hardly been worn. The clothes I buy my grandchildren when I go in there, you would think they were brand new, but people turn them in because their children never got a chance to wear them. They outgrew them so fast. So that's how. And then the other thing about people like Steve Harvey and all these people who are put on a pedestal, when you look into the character of these men, they have no morals. They're successful, yes. A lot of these people who are on a pedestal, they have horrible morals. Their life is. They can tell a story, but they ain't telling the whole story about their immoral life. So we should stop putting them on a pedestal because they're making millions of dollars. There's another story to that. Now, your guest yesterday, I would put him more on a pedestal. Dr. V. Issa White, I think his name. He has a background that's worth praising and admiring and following. But some of these people, we should just leave them alone, put them on the side. Now, you said something about consumers. We're all consuming. That's the thing. Tiny houses, homeless people ought to be consuming tiny houses. Homeless, unhoused people ought to be looking at how to build their own house. That's what we're promoting for people who are feeling like they don't have an option to live in a decent place. Come here to It's My House or BIY housing and learn how to build your own house. That's what we're missing in our society. People have no skills. They're consume, consume, consume. And I'm promoting, this is Viata, your holistic life coach, promoting consume only what's going to bring value to your life, like Melaleuca.com. If you can look at what you consume on a monthly basis, we're all consuming something on a monthly basis. You can go and shop in one location other than your food and get what you normally consume every month and get paid for it. That's smart. That seems smarter to me. So that's why I'm promoting Melaleuca, because that's
Let me ask you this. All right. Now, you're originally from Chicago. Now, you... if you wouldn't mind sharing with people, now you live, you're in your second tiny house now, which you helped basically build out of a shed. But would you share with us the big house that you were living in California, and then you came, you and your family moved to Florida to, I don't know if it was a bigger house, but it was a bigger house with a pool. And then you went, share that, share your journey with us. Because I, the reason I want you to share with us, I also share, because you had to adjust psychologically with each move, because you went from big to tiny. The mic is
yours. And that's why, as you know, I have a ebook called Creating the Oddest Tiny House Village, or Creating a Tiny House Village. So when you get married, you have needs, you have values that are different from when you get a divorce, right? That's kind of my journey in a nutshell. Marriage, you're looking to build, start a family, two children, you need a bigger house. We moved from California into a bigger house in Florida because houses, you get more for your money in Florida than you do California. So then you have stay in that big house with a pool, two-car garage, all that. You got two, raising two sons, four bedrooms, two baths. And then it's time for a divorce, okay, 20 years later. So your values keep changing. That's what we want your listeners to think about. What do you value today that you didn't value 30 years ago? I don't value a big house with a two-car garage and a swimming pool. That's too much work, too much maintenance, too much work, and I don't have a need because I don't have my sons are grown now. So my needs as a senior and with my knowledge and experience in the holistic health field, I just need a laptop and some Wi-Fi and a small house and a place where I can use my essential oils and stay healthy in my late 60s, almost 70. So we our values change, L.A. Harvey's doing now, he has the value in money because he's a star. He's promoting his business, blah, blah, blah. But he's not us. We all have different values. We're consumers. Number one, we're all consumers. That's what we have in common. So what are you consuming every month that has value for you? Obviously, most people are stocking up on the food. And by the way, water. You're giving away your at water. It's water. Water. Water's in the air. When you look at my friend Elitam Elamim, who's a breatharian, a solitarian, he's not drinking water. He's not eating food. He walked from South Africa to Uganda on his feet, okay? No water, no food. This man has mastered absorbing nourishment, nutrients from the sky, the sun, the moon, the trees. And that's on the way end of the spectrum of nourishment. What do we eat? What do we do? I mean, you got people on the other end of the spectrum. They got to have three meals a day. They got to have meat. They got to have potatoes. They got to have snacks. They got to have chips. They got to have popcorn. All this crap that slows down the body. So if we can all move a little further toward the breatharian lifestyle where we absorb water in the air. The matter of your consciousness, knowing that you don't have to be drinking a ton of water, but you do have to have a consciousness that says, I can be nourished by the sun, number one. I can be nourished by the trees. I can be nourished by the grass, the birds, the bees. All out in nature nourishes us. But we don't have that consciousness that Elitam Elamim has in Uganda. So we got to start today recognizing what do we value as consumers, and then we're going to make more money when we let go of things that are not bringing us value or wealth. And that's just a whole list of things, and we don't want to look at Steve Harvey and his wife prancing around in their jewels and their gold and all these other superstars prancing around showing off their wealth instead of helping people build houses. How about that? All these people making all this money, we got a homeless population that's off the chain. And what are they doing with that money? Going to the Academy Awards, prancing around, showing their wealth, doing this, doing that, showing their wealth. Forget about these people. We don't even want to put them on a pedestal anymore because they're not helping the communities. So it's up to us to build something new, build new houses, build new businesses, build new wealth that doesn't look like Steve Harvey and all these other, well, the Jasmina clothes person. We don't need any more children's clothes. Sorry, honey, you do your thing, but that ain't going to last because people are going to realize that's a waste of money, really, spending $40 on one outfit for a child or even $20 on one outfit for a child that's going to outgrow that item in like 3 months maybe. No, we are getting smarter and wiser thanks to you.
Well, no, see, now, you're speaking, I'm not disagreeing with you. You're speaking from, you've got, you know, some life experiences behind you. Like you say, you've raised two sons to adulthood. Now you have grandchildren. Now, you take the 21-year-old who just had their first child, and they're, because, I mean, basically we're a nation, the United States, not only the United States, but for sake of this conversation, the United States, we're hyper-consumers in this country. And in my opinion, we eat too much, drink too much, pop too many pills, it's just too much. But, I mean, we live in a culture where people have died over a pair of tennis shoes. So when it comes to, a lot of parents take a lot of pride in how good their baby, I mean, what their two-year-old, their toddler, whatever you call them, at two years old, how well they look with their Nike sweatsuit on or whatever, you know, whatever they're buying these days, I don't know. So you're right, you have to educate them, but some people, I could be wrong, they don't want to be educated. They want,
well, they're
going to
go poor.
They want to look
They're
good.
Going to be poor. They're going to be poor, L.A., and then that'll be the lesson for them. Once you're poor, you ain't got no money, you got all this debt because you're buying all these clothes. I had a woman tell me about her daughter. Her daughter and her husband were both working. The kids are in daycare, two small children, and she wants her husband to get a better job because they're not making enough money. It's like, no. When you have two kids, that's your priority. You don't need to spend more time away from your children. But that's the society we live in. They think they got to have what the Joneses have or the Harveys have. Instead of toning down, living in a trailer maybe and build a tiny house, and then when the children are older, do your thing. But these children are so messed up because their parents ain't giving them any attention at a young age. Children need attention at a young age. They don't need you working three jobs to give them Gucci bags and clothes that they're not going to wear very long. That's the wisdom that is lacking in our society. And it's because a lot of these young people ain't listening to their grandparents who went through all this suffering and pain, and now they're trying to help you avoid it, but you don't want to listen. So guess what? Suffering and pain is going to knock on their doors, and they're going to have to learn the hard way.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let's switch gears. Look at my building. Chris, what's the latest on your end? And thanks again for that guest that you arranged for us yesterday, Dr. White.
Well, he actually wound up doing the other radio show that I do in the evening last night. And, you know, I like the fact that he's ready to go boots on the ground. He's ready to energize people, you know, bring them together and actually make a difference in the community, whether he gets, whether he wins or not, you know, he can make a difference. And I think, you know, right now, we have the opportunity to start doing something on the weekends with a building thing and actually maybe utilizing the few hours, the 4 hours that this show doesn't air.
Yeah. Saturday, Sunday. I got 2 hours available on Saturday and Sunday, so he's welcome to either one of them or both.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of seeing. If, like today, you know, we're doing a light open house today right there in Orlando. There's people that can go out and see what it is that we are offering as far as the shipping container housing. I'm looking for the flyer right here. The address where it's at is 4147 North G
John Young Parkway, Lot 9 in Orlando. Now, next week will be the full open house, but he is there today, and you can go by and see it. Next week, Dr. White will be there for the open house, and we're going to try to push as many people in everything that he's doing this week to go to that open house next week.
Okay.
And at the same time, it'd be awesome if we could do a 7-8-1 build at the open house that day and have something else for people to see that they can do, you know, actually show them the construction of this. We do have that ability. It's next week.
Okay, that's what, next Saturday?
Next Saturday, yep.
Okay. All right.
And if anybody wants to order a home, I spoke with my factory, and one of my factories just bought 3 more machines, have a total of 5. So they make 10 feet of material per second. And they told me that if anybody places an order, they can have an order ready for me within that week. And if I have any special sizes of material, instead of the commercial size of our material is 3 5/8 instead of 3 1/2. And then your 2x6, everything's 1/8 inch bigger, and that's because they want you to use commercial doors and windows. So he's going to make 2x4 size material, 2x6 material, and 2x8 material. So you can use everything in the regular lumber yards, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Menards. You can use anything in that store to build this house. So you do not have to buy a better window or door. You can utilize this. So we're going to go with all that dimensions of 3 1/2, 5 1/2, and 7 1/2. That's your 2x4, 2x6, and 2x8s. And these are that's the only thing that might hold me up is if we have a big order and we're running them and we have to switch the machines over, because it takes 2.5 hours now to switch a machine over from making one size material to another. But they're willing to do it. And I found out that I can ship on a regular axle, a single frame truck, not a semi, on a 40-foot truck, I can ship at least 20 house packages, maybe more. So I might be able to do 40 houses on one truck and cost the same amount to deliver it as it does to deliver the one.
All right.
Chris, what time is that event on John Young today?
They're there now. It's at 11 a.m. next Friday as well.
Okay. The same location.
Same location.
Mm-hmm. I forgot I was going to ask Chris a question. I forgot where I was going to ask. All right, well, that's all gone. All right, well, so he's welcome to come on next week. If he needs any time on the weekend, let me know.
Oh, definitely.
And,
I'm sure that he would love to, and I know that he'll be back on my other show tonight. I was thinking he was going
to
be back on
the show. Oh, that's the question I wanted to ask. Now, how can we listen to you at night? Time and how and all that stuff.
It is at 8 o'clock Central Time, 9 o'clock Eastern. It's on Blog Talk Radio. It's Lone Wolf is the name of the show. And,
oh, well, that's a good title.
And the show's been going for over 20 years. We just had our 5,000th episode last Friday, and we look for getting 5,000 more. You know,
Lone Wolf, that's the name of the podcast, okay, on Blog Talk Radio. So we just go to Blog Talk and
I'm sorry?
L-O-N-E or A-N?
That's all in the PM.
No, is it L-O-A-N or L-O-N-E?
Oh, no. L-O-N-E, Wolf.
Okay. Yeah. And that's 8 tonight.
Yeah, it'll be 9 o'clock Eastern.
Well, 9 our time, yeah.
On Blog Talk, okay. All right, thanks, Chris.
Yeah, 6 p.m. On the West Coast.
Now, what you know what, I'll just go through their archives and see what, you know, what kind of topics they talk.
They, what that show is it talks about everything going on in the world. So it's all facts. We have some major researchers, and everything that we speak with facts behind it. And we want to tell the world what's going on that you don't know, that you should know, and what we need to do, putting things in action to get these things to stop happening to us, because people are making decisions for every person on earth, and they're not even people that we elected. So that show, that's all it is. And it talks about anything and everything we can possibly get that we have research on. And, you know, when we look at technology today and how long that this country, or not just this country, but period, having patents on mind control. Makes no sense to me. But to have over 3,500 patents on things to control your mind, these are one of the things we'll talk about.
Well, they call it psychological warfare.
Yeah, exactly. And right now, we wound up reading off like 50 of these patents, and I picked 6 of them out of the 50 randomly. And those 6, you could see that those 6 could dictate everything that's happened in my life. Just those 6. Now there's 3,500 other ones. And these are being implemented today, right now, in our phones, in our televisions, everything. There is things that there's an interrupter switch that's in every television, every radio, every phone, and they can turn it on externally and give you subliminal messages through your phone. That was one of the 6 that I picked. So, you know, when that show, you know, we're kind of all, yesterday it was about nonprofits and what they, you know, what they can do to help themselves and help others, you know, come together and do something stronger than what they are, because most nonprofits all work individually. They don't work in unity. So we're trying to show that one, you know, pay attention to what is going on over here, because maybe they might be doing something that can help you, but maybe you're doing something that can help them. But being aware and actually working together is a key component. So, but yeah, it's hard telling what our shows are and what they're going to be on, but what they are going to be on is what is happening in the world right now, and gives people opportunity to discuss on whether we can do something to change it. We can get involved and seeing what's being passed throughout our country and our world as far as laws. But the biggest one, you know, we talk about clothing right here, you know, going out and buying clothes for your kids and they outgrow them. Well, they've got a new thing out, and it's a social credit score. And if your credit score isn't enough, they dictate whether you can even walk in that store. And that is all happening right now this year. By September, there's going to be a total change. And it could be when you go to change your clothes, you don't own them. You only rent them. So you'll look in your closet and the clothes that are in there, you're only going to have them for a certain amount of time, and you got to go get them back. So these are the kind of stupid things that's going on in the world that we do talk about, and we want people to realize so that we can make our own choices and not have people choose for us.
Okay. That's tonight at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, and that's the Lone Wolf podcast on Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, sir.
Now, let's see. Is it? All right. I'm looking on Blog Talk. Is it April? Oh, wait a minute. Let's see. What was the topic last night? Was it Killer Davenport and the Wild Man of Radio, or what? Maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing.
No, that's it. Tyler Davenport.
Tyler Davenport.
Yep.
Okay, that's the one. Okay, I got it. All right, so that's the time tonight. All right, I'll tune in.
All right, thank you, guys.
And on that note, Viotta, you have your topic for Sunday?
No, not yet, but it's all-purpose healing. All the topics come during the week when we realize what everybody needs to hear from the events happening this week. So it'll be an enlightening show on the current events of this week, which are many, you know, so I have five, which is the most important topic. But with the war going on and the constant war and migrants coming in, we always have plenty to talk about on how we can stay calm and in peace despite the chaos and turmoil around us.
Got it. All right, on that note, everyone have a good week.